Almost every Star Trek fan will tell you that the best of the movie versions was the second one, The Wrath of Khan. Nicholas Meyer wrote and directed it, as well as two of the others, but why he was an unlikely choice for the project has finally been revealed in his new book for Viking called The View from the Bridge. Nicholas Meyer also adapted his own novel into the screenplay for The 7% Solution. He wrote and directed Time After Time, and more recently he adapted Philip Roth's The Dying Animal for the screen as Elegy with Ben Kingsley and Penelope Cruz. I'm very pleased to welcome him here to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Weren't you worried with this title that some people might assume this book was about Arthur Miller?
No.
Because his is A View from the Bridge.
Yes.
And this is, you're really talking about the bridge, the Star Trek bridge?
The bridge of the Starship Enterprise, yes.
Had you ever seen the Star Trek series on television before you signed on to direct the movie?
Well, they showed me episodes from the television show, and I watched the first film. But growing up, when it was on television, I really didn't get it. I was preoccupied, I suppose, when I saw it by all the wrong things. Why is it that everywhere they go, there's breathable atmosphere? Why is gravity always the same, no matter what planet they're on? I was so busy with the science, in a way, that I was missing the fiction or the analogies.
This is what ruins science fiction for certain kinds of people. I always wondered what would happen when Superman jumped off of a ledge. Action equals reaction. He'd probably destroy the windowsill. But you never see anything crumbling when he jumped off.
Yeah, well, I was very preoccupied by such things as this and why they were all running around in pajamas. So I was not an initial fan.
Were you somebody who wanted to make movies? You went to the University of Iowa. I don't think that is... There are too many film directors who've come out of that school.
Well, there's actually a lot of actors who've come out and a lot of playwrights. Tennessee Williams was there, wrote The Glass Menagerie there. Dark of the Moon was written there. Gene Wilder went there. John Anderson went there. I'm blanking, but there's a long list of people who came out of the theater side of it.
And that's what you went there for, theater?
Yeah. Theater and film and a liberal arts education back then, which is shortly after the Civil War, there weren't that many universities that were offering all those things. And it was also the home of the Writers' Workshop, and I wanted to be part of the playwriting workshop.
But you were a New Yorker?
Yes, East 62nd Street, yeah.
And did your family have any show business background?
No, none. My dad was a psychoanalyst and my mother was a concert pianist. I mean, I suppose
that sounds like a preparation.
Yeah, good show business background.
Is it safe to say that you owe a lot of your career to the 1972 Writers Guild strike?
Well, it is safe to yes, in a way it is, because it was during the Writers Guild strike, when you weren't allowed to write screenplays, that I sat down to write my Sherlock Holmes pastiche, The 7% Solution. Just as last January's Writers Guild strike was the opportunity to write my memoir. There's a funny line in Nanochka where Melvin Douglas says to Ina Clare that he's going to sell her memoirs, and he says, "Darling, we won't have to worry about our future if you'll let me raffle off your past."
Well, some might say it takes a lot of chutzpah to write a Sherlock Holmes pastiche for a first novel. What gave you the idea for The 7% Solution?
Well, The 7% Solution germinated for over a decade. It really began, I suppose, in high school with kids saying to me, "Oh, your old man's a shrink. Is he a Freudian?" And I didn't know. So I said to him, "Pop, are you a Freudian?" And he said, "It's a silly question." And I said, "Why? Why is it a silly question?" And he said, "Because it's no more possible to discuss the history with psychoanalysis without starting with Freud than you can discuss the history of America without starting with Native Americans or Columbus. But to suppose that nothing has happened since Columbus, that's pretty rigid. That's pretty doctrinaire. And when a person comes to see me, I listen to what they say. I listen to how they say it. I'm very curious as to what they don't say. And against this, I apply a background of some clinical experience to try to figure out from clues from them as to why they are not happy." And at this point, I had my first epiphany of who Sherlock Holmes had always reminded me of, was my dad. And from there, I sort of fell to wondering over the next decade how much Arthur Conan Doyle knew about the life and writing of Sigmund Freud. And the first thing you realize is, oh, they're both doctors. Okay. And then, oh, they both died in London within 9 years of each other. Oh, okay. And then you realize that Freud had this very heavy involvement with cocaine. And you realize
early in his life.
Early in his life, yeah. And then when a friend of his died of it, he sort of unofficially became disenchanted with it. And meanwhile, Holmes was a cocaine addict, and his medical man, Watson, was far in advance of contemporary feeling and law, by the way, in deciding that this was like a bad thing. So one thing sort of led to another, and then the Writers Guild goes on strike, and the woman with whom I was cohabiting said, well, now you can write this book you're always yammering about, and she was right.
Well, I've always thought that one of the things that we get out of fiction is insight. One of the pleasures of reading good fiction is insight, and that's what a shrink is supposed to also give us, isn't it?
Yes, shrinks to me, I write about this in my latest book, which everything I say now seems like I'm quoting myself. It's very eerie. It's like living in an echo chamber. Shrinks are like film editors. When you're shooting a scene, you get lost in the process. You're tripping over cables. You're in the moment. You're fighting. We're losing the light. People are yelling at you about money, whatever. And then you turn over all this footage that you've been shooting to your editor, and if he's a good editor and if he's understood what you're trying to do, he'll play it back for you. He hooks it up. He arranges it back and forth, and you recognize it. And there is insight because, wow, you didn't even realize some of the things you were photographing. You were so busy getting the shot. And I think being in analysis is not unlike that, to the degree that you're turning over the dailies of your head, the flashbacks, the voiceovers, the close-ups, the whatever. And then at the end of the hour, or whatever they're calling it, the guy plays it back for you and says, today this is what I heard. And if he's a good analyst, and if he understands you, then there is some resonance to what he's saying, the insight, to use your word.
Nicholas Meyer is my guest. He's written a memoir called The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood. It's published by Viking. It is kind of a miracle that the book got published, because you only knew the name of one editor when you flew to New York, and then you discovered he didn't work at the publishing house anymore.
You are talking not about The View from the Bridge, but
no.
The 7% Solution.
Yeah, back to the story we were talking about.
Yeah, when I finished writing it, and I thought, well, this is publishable, and I did have agents, and there was a literary branch of the East Coast office, and the lady said to me on the phone, well, I've never read any Sherlock Holmes, so there's no point in my reading this book, because how could I tell if it was any good? And I answered in somewhat intemperate fashion. I was intemperate then, but I'm not now. How can you call yourself a literary agent? You've never read Arthur Conan Doyle, and besides, if my book depends on another book, it's already a flop. But she'd hung up by then. So I got on the plane, and I did know one person in the publishing business. So I went in pouring rain from JFK to Macmillan, which was where I'd known him to be. And I was young enough that I didn't even understand that people moved from one publishing house to another, or that anybody left their job. I've only had one job all my life, and I'll never leave it. This is it. So I said, is he still in the publishing business? When they told me, dripping in front of the receptionist desk, that he didn't work there anymore. And they said, oh, yes, he was across town. And so I schlepped my package across town, and eventually it was published by E.P. Dutton, and Yuri Jajevics was the editor.
And you had a bestseller, a real success, and Hollywood wanted to make a film. You made a deal to sell the movie rights, but only if you were hired to write the screenplay. Was that where you really had wanted to go?
Yeah, I wanted to make movies, and that's why I was living in Hollywood in the first place, and I'd written a couple of television movies by then. It was all interrupted by the writer's strike.
And you wrote this the script, and it was directed by Herb Ross, a good director. Did you learn a lot from working with him?
I learned a tremendous amount from working with Herb, because he also let me stay on the set and watch, because he...
Oh, that's very generous. A lot of directors won't do that.
Yes, the writer is a necessary evil dispensed with at the earliest opportunity.
You also had to have been thrilled by the cast. I mean, Robert Duvall and Laurence Olivier.
Yes.
Can't get much better than that.
No, it was the whole thing was such a high-class operation. Olivier, who had been my sort of boyhood idol, and when Herb said, what do you think about Olivier as Professor Moriarty? And I was hard put to keep a straight face and start leaping on the tabletop and sort of tearing off my shirt and saying, oh, yes, this... What a good idea. And then I had all these fantasies after I learned he'd been cast that between now and 6 months later when we were going to make the movie, he would die or I would die or neither of us would die, but I'd never get to meet him and so on and so on and so forth. Duvall I helped cast because this was a revisionist tale and I was always sick of Watson being portrayed as an idiot because I never understood why a genius hangs out with an idiot.
Just to show us how smart he is, I guess.
Yeah, but I thought Holmes's vanity is bigger than that, and he could show how smart he was next to a regular person. He didn't need a buffoon, and that didn't match the voice of Watson in the Doyle stories anyway.
Then you didn't want to write a follow-up and spoke to Francis Ford Coppola and Ulu Grossbart. What advice did they give you?
Well, I found myself having dinner with... Coppola about 3 days before he won the next slew of Oscars for Godfather 2, and he was busy whipping up a large bowl of pasta, and I said, why did you make the second movie? I've seen it. It's a masterpiece. It's its own justification, but what prompted you? And he said three reasons, which he didn't give me in any particular order, or rather he specified there is no particular order. They offered him an enormous amount of money to do it. Secondly, he was very curious to see if he could go back to this material and mine it for more meaning. And thirdly, and I thought most interestingly, he was troubled by the first movie, which he found amoral. And he wanted to give it a moral perspective. Ulu Grossbart said, you know, do this because an artist's life is uncertain and sometimes you're hot, sometimes you're cold, you'll have money for a rainy day, you'll have money to fail with if you want to try something. So between the two of them, I agreed to do the West End Horror and I wrote it and I'm glad I did.
And Coppola was talking about revisionism. You said that you were thinking in those terms when you were thinking about the Sherlock Holmes story later. You went through a similar process when you're thinking about Star Trek. But in between, there was time after time. And you got to direct that as well.
Yeah,
I guess directing is where you always had wanted to go. They say everybody in Hollywood wants to direct.
They say it. I went to Hollywood because that's what I wanted to do, and I didn't know how to get to do it other than writing my way in.
That's how Coppola got started.
Yeah. It's not a state secret that this is a way to do it. It's not, I don't think, particularly how Steven Spielberg did it. I mean, he did it on his own directorial merits and worked his way up through the ranks. I did it the way Francis did it as a screenwriter, and I sold my book on condition that I write the screenplay, and the next time around I sold the screenplay on condition that I direct.
That was about time travel. A lot of people will remember it with great fondness. And it was a success.
Yes.
So here you are, connected to two successful films. And where did you go from there? They didn't offer you the Star Trek right after that, did they?
What happened was that there was a novel that I had adapted as a screenplay that my heart was panting on the floor for, in the end, what proved to be 16 years trying to make Robertson Davies' novel Fifth Business into a movie which I called Conjuring. And I was getting nowhere with it. In Watson's phrase, it was a story for which the world is not yet prepared, as a movie anyway, and apparently still isn't. And a friend of mine said to me, Nicky, if you want to learn how to direct, you should be directing and not just sort of holding your breath waiting for this one thing to happen. So she put me together with Harve Bennett down at Paramount, who had been assigned to produce a second Star Trek feature.
My guest is Nicholas Meyer, who is director of Star Trek II and six. Actually, there were three Star Treks that you did. His memoir is called The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood, published by Viking. So you took this even though you didn't really feel any connection to the Star Trek because you hadn't watched it on television. But you say that you got an insight. You saw a connection to between Star Trek and C.S. Forrester's work.
Yeah, when I went down to meet Harve Bennett, and it was really my feeling for him as a person and his enthusiasm, and then they showed me some episodes, and they showed me the original movie, and I was tickled at the back of my mind that this resembled something that, in fact, I did have a great deal of affection for, and for a long time I couldn't figure out what it was, and then a couple days later, I woke up in the middle of the night and said, well, oh, it's Captain Hornblower. It's Captain Horatio Hornblower, that English sea captain during
the... So Captain Kirk is Horatio Hornblower in another century?
In outer space, yeah. And when I actually mentioned this to Bill Shatner when we met, he sparked and he said, oh, yes, Gene Roddenberry said it was Hornblower. He also said it was Wagon Train in outer space. So I guess, you pays your money and you takes your choice.
And there was a script already written, wasn't there?
There were five scripts. What happened was Harve Bennett said, I will send you, we have draft five coming in a couple of weeks and I'll send it to you. And I said, fine. And I went about my business and I looked up and it was maybe a month later. And I called him. I said, what happened to the script you were going to send me? And he said, oh, I can't send it. It's not good. He had actually a rather colorful phrase. He said, my tits in a ringer. And I said, I'm come again? And anyway, he said, listen, it isn't any good. And I said, well, what about draft four or three? And he said, kid, they always call you kid, you don't get it. These are all different versions of a second Star Trek movie. They're not related to one another. They're just different attempts by different authors. So I said, well, send them all up. And so me, slow reader, I plowed through this wagon load of screenplays and came up with the suggestion that maybe we should just take the things we liked from each one and combine them into a new movie, which is eventually what happened.
Now, the first one had been directed by Robert Wise of Sound of Music fame. Actually, I love his The Gunfighter.
There's a lot of good Robert Wise movies, and he was also the editor of Citizen Kane.
But you didn't like his film.
I don't even think he liked it. I think there's a version of it now which was recut by him. Star Trek the Motion Picture, 1979, was what's called a runaway production. It cost $45 million in 1979, and at the end they were hemorrhaging so much red ink that he wasn't allowed to finish the movie. They just put it out there. And I'm not going to knock that movie because I don't think ours would have been as good without seeing it.
Do you think, is that one of the reasons you were put on such a tight budget?
Oh, sure.
Because you didn't have all the money to do all the special effects you would like. You couldn't go back to Jerry Goldsmith to do the music.
No, we were extremely constricted compared to what happened on the first movie. In fact, Star Trek II was actually produced by the television division at Paramount, presumably because they would do it more economically.
Now, I understand William Shatner hated the script when he first saw it. I have to tell you, I've spent some time with William Shatner, and I found him to be a very difficult person. How was he to work with once the shoot began?
They were all great, actually, to work with.
They had bickered during the TV series. They were happier with your script?
Well, first of all, I think, eventually, Bill Shatner's objections to the screenplay, when I calmed down enough to parse them, weren't particularly difficult to overcome. He just felt strongly that that Kirk was the hero and that he should be pushing events forward rather than bringing up the rear, which sometimes in the original draft I guess he was. So it was easy to fix. And I think the cast of this enterprise, of this ship, the crew of this ship, had willy-nilly been together for so long that they had grown, I think, to some degree philosophical and certainly professional about their relationship to these roles, and they were certainly used to different directors coming in every week to direct them. So they were kind to me, and it is the director's job to find out how different actors work, what their process is, and how to get the best out of them. And I had to learn that with Bill and Leonard and all the rest.
And you brought in some newcomers, like the girl who became fixated on the Vulcan ears.
Kirstie Alley, yeah.
Who's had a career since. And you also had Ricardo Montalban, one of the great Hollywood stars of the past.
He was Ricardo, with whom I formed a very close friendship, was the only actor that I didn't get to really rehearse with before we started, because he was doing Fantasy Island. And when somebody said, "Why did you do Fantasy Island?" he said, "Because my kids needed braces." And Ricardo had a very long career in movies, I mean, enormously long. And I was hesitant to open my mouth when we started working, because I watched him play the opening scene in the movie and I thought, oh boy, because it was being sort of bellowed, and I thought, he's made more movies than I've had years. What will happen if I try to talk to him? But he was very, very receptive, and he got excited. He said, "Oh, you're going to direct me. This is great. I need direction. I don't know what I'm doing up there." And so it was became a very intimate collaboration.
I understand you had a showdown with Barry Diller, who was then the Paramount chairman, at a screening of the film.
Yes. I mean, all this is recounted in excruciating detail in the book. But
this suggests that nobody knows what's going to be a hit, ultimately, because the film was a huge hit.
It was a colossal. It was the biggest opening weekend in the history of movies. But nobody does know. I mean, movies is a crapshoot. And as they become more expensive, the choices about what movies to make are increasingly conservative, even though that's still a crapshoot. There's a big studio that spends $200 million to film a comic book, loses their shirt, spends another $200 million to film a comic book, loses their shirts, spend another film $200 million to do Terminator 4, and gives away Slumdog Millionaire. So nobody knows anything in William Goldman's memorable formulation.
Well, do you think that people in Hollywood even like movies, or do they just see them as a business? Is it different from stocking a Walmart store?
Now that's what it's become. It used to be that the people who made movies, who owned the studios, were people who were passionate about movies. If you go back to the beginning, they were, many of them, illiterate Russian immigrants. And movies, which were silent movies, spoke to them as an international language. And over the first 50 years of movie studios, they were passionate about stories and movies, and not as money-making machine, but actually as the movie. And if the movie flopped, Harry Cohn could still say, "Well, I liked it," and it was his company. Once the companies were absorbed by corporations, and usually corporations bought into movie studios to meet girls. Charlie Bluedorn wanted to meet girls, so he added a movie studio to Gulf and Western. But in the 70s, which is when all these takeovers happened, they had the first movie mega hits: Jaws, the Godfather movies, Close Encounters, and what Everett Dirksen said, a million here, a million there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Nicholas Meyer is a novelist, screenwriter, and director in addition to the Star Trek films. His many credits include an Oscar nomination for the screenplay for 7% Solution. He also directed and wrote the classic Time After Time, directed The Day After, which became the most watched television movie of the time.
Ever.
Ever. Okay. And now he's written a memoir called The View from the Bridge. It is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, I was pleased to be asked.